But the Constitution has had its own day for only 12 years now, more than two centuries after its drafting. Why the revolution is more celebrated than the Constitution might be the subject of another lecture. Let me read you a bit of President Obama's Constitution Day proclamation last year. He hasn't issued one yet, or at least at 4 o'clock this afternoon, he had not issued one for this year. These early patriots understood what it meant to be an American. They succeeded in crafting a document that enshrines our enduring faith in the notion that being a citizen is about more than circumstances of birth. We are bound together by our beliefs, our unalienable rights, and the idea that we must accept certain obligations to one another and to future generations. In what has become the supreme law of our land, and in the ensuing amendments to it, we see a reflection of our founding fathers' insistence that the task of perfecting our union is never finished. We must constantly take up the critical work of bettering ourselves and our society. These ideals have driven America forward from her nascence on the common cobblestone streets of Philadelphia through today, and we continue to shine as a beacon of hope and freedom to the rest of the world. That's the end of my quote from Obama's declaration. How shall we, then, here this evening, commemorate this document? By some sort of inquiry, I would think, and in this presidential election season, with the voting set to begin next week, it is perhaps fitting that we should inquire into how we go about electing a president. During the ratification debates, Alexander Hamilton, one of the drafters, and now a Broadway star, wrote, "The mode of appointment of the chief magistrate of the United States is almost the only part of the system of any consequence which has escaped without severe censure, or which has received the slightest mark of approbation from its opponents. I, Alexander Hamilton, hesitate not to affirm, that is, I don't hesitate to affirm, that if the manner of it be not perfect, it is at least excellent." And Alexis de Tocqueville, writing almost 50 years later, praised this mode of appointment as likely to express, "without delay, the real will of the people, hardly exciting their passions, and with more guarantee of the goodness of the choice." Now, these men were writing about a mode of appointment in which, as a matter of law, you and I do not vote for a president. Instead, we vote for an elector who, using his own judgment, in turn votes for a president. In a few minutes, I will look closely at this mode of appointment, its form, some of the reasons behind it, some of the difficulties and paradoxes that lie close to its surface. But for now, I mean only to highlight what many of you know already, that Americans are quite divided now on this system, some defending the original design, and others pushing for election of the president by the people directly, without intervention of electors. And I'll wager that part of this division can, and perhaps should, be understood as coming about because we also disagree about what the office itself should be: chief magistrate, as Hamilton calls the president, or royalty, as much of a presidential campaign suggests. And there's the ancient division between those who believe the people should rule directly and those who argue that the people should rule through intermediaries of their own choosing. Both attitudes were strikingly in full view this last summer when the people of Great Britain voted by popular referendum to leave the European Union. But the prime minister, who must execute this exit, became prime minister by action of her own party in Parliament, with no popular vote on her appointment, and less than 3 weeks after the referendum. I hope this evening to put all of us in a position to see better the difficulties of choosing a president. I have no grand proposal. I'll raise questions about the one grand proposal on the table right now, in which the state of Maryland has played a leading role. The proposal, if enacted, would in effect do away with the original design entirely, except in name, and in its place rely entirely on the popular vote. But I also raise questions about the original plan, the one of 1787. From the start, it seemed doomed. I won't be talking about racial or class discrimination in access to voting, or what candidates you should vote for, or what the most important policy questions are. I'm seeking here a greater understanding of the difficulties of constitution making. These are issues that will exist even if all racial discrimination were to disappear tomorrow, and even if there was widespread understanding of all the crucial issues. But I don't want to claim too much for what I attempt here this evening. In 1823, as another presidential election loomed, James Madison, another of the great drafters of 1787, suggested in a letter to a friend some modest changes to the then current provisions for electing a president. He said that what he had written may be more superficial than he had been aware, so he didn't want his letter to become public, and perhaps you won't tell anyone what I say here tonight. But there's more. Between the time he was writing and the 1824 election, nothing could be done about the mode of electing the president. And to nonetheless discuss that mode, he thought, would invite the forming of opinions that could obstruct timely discussion of that mode. Because near an election, every topic is likely to be viewed only in the light of the election and not in the light of all cases. Following this reasoning of Madison's, we might think it is perhaps not fitting in an election season to discuss how to elect a president, but I hope only to encourage further discussion, not obstruct it. Let me say right here at the start of inquiry, please consider that voting and discussion are incompatible in the following sense. You can't do both at the same time. If you're still discussing, you're not voting, and vice versa. Surely one could lead to the other, but if you had to vote, discussion failed. Voting is a substitute for agreement on the basis of discussion, and we should be thankful that there is such a device, for the main other device is physical force. When we vote, we are prepared to lose and to live with that loss. I'm not quite sure how anyone is ever quite persuaded to abide by the result of a vote that they have lost. But the Constitution takes that as a given. And in some of its devices, the Constitution works to avoid tempting anyone to reject a vote. And note, because voting involves numbers, it is subject to certain paradoxes, and these paradoxes have practical consequences, in particular for the mode of electing the chief magistrate. The handout you have sets out one of those paradoxes, and I'll walk you through it later. Perhaps if I want to know how a president should be appointed, I should ask first, what is a president? Here's one beginning, but only a beginning, of an answer to that question. The president is not royalty of old. No matter the entourage which follows him around, or the grand ceremony surrounding his office, or his informal title, leader of the free world, or the number of times when he was a candidate, he said, when I am president, I will do X or do Y, with no mention of the role of Congress in what gets done or the limits imposed by the judiciary. The person who becomes president serves for a limited time, and during that time, she can be removed from office by Congress. While she is in office, she puts into effect laws written by someone else. Even her much talked about power to write regulations depends entirely on authority given her either by statute or the Constitution, and Congress can revise or revoke any of those regulations. She is commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but under budgets and rules passed by Congress. She can veto any legislation, but her veto can be overridden by large enough votes in Congress. She can appoint men and women to the chief offices of the executive and judicial branches, but only with the consent of the Senate, She can make treaties with other nations, but again, only with the consent of the Senate. She might hope that a child or spouse of hers would rise to the same office. It has happened and may be about to happen again. But that child or spouse cannot in law have the office simply because he is family. Were it otherwise, the president's power not subject to so many limitations, it could be argued, and has been argued by Tocqueville and others, that election with such great power would be incompatible, because the stakes would be too high, and the election of the president would be, in Tocqueville's words, not merely a cause of agitation, but a cause of ruin. Two things Abraham Lincoln said help keep the office and its holder in proper perspective. When he was young, he said that there was no place in the United States for an Alexander, a Caesar, or a Napoleon. And at the start of the Civil War, he said, to quote, "There is scarcely a regiment of about 1,000 people from which there could not be selected a president, a cabinet, a Congress, and perhaps a court, abundantly competent to administer the government itself." Let me now set out the elements of the mode of appointment the Constitution set forth originally. Some of these elements proved to be sources of difficulties and were in some cases either changed by later amendment or modified in practice. Other of the difficulties are still with us. All of them would be in substance, though not in form, abolished by what I'm calling the grand proposal in which Maryland is a leader. First element, each state is to choose electors, but in whatever way its legislature thinks best, though no one holding federal office can be an elector. The way states have chosen electors have varied greatly from outright popular vote to appointment by the state legislature. As far as I know, the Supreme Court has never overturned any of these greatly varying ways, though the court in the case that in effect settled the election of 2000 in favor of Mr. Bush did rule against Florida's proposed method of recounting its popular vote on the grounds that the method did not treat all voters equally. Maryland would like to think that its own grand proposal would meet the court's approval. For reasons I'll give later, I'm very doubtful. Second element, each state is to have as many electors as it has senators and representatives in Congress. That gives small states a bit of an edge because those small states have fewer representatives than big states have. Every state has two senators. Third element, in the original text of the Constitution, the electors were to meet in their respective states and cast two votes for president. But an early amendment requires that one of the two votes be for vice president. Thereby hangs a tale about Alexander Hamilton, one I don't think got to Broadway, but later. At least one of the votes had to be for someone who is not a citizen of the elector's own state. That prevents a situation in which every elector votes for someone in his own state, and so no national candidate emerges. Fourth, the vote counts are forwarded to Congress. In the original provision, the candidate with the greatest number of votes became the president, and the candidate with the next greatest, the vice president. The votes for president had to represent a majority of the electors, and if there were two such majorities, which is possible when an elector each has two votes, the House of Representatives chose by ballot which one would be president. And if no candidate had a majority, the House would choose from among the top five vote-getters. It's now the top three. Oddly, in these cases in which the House was obliged to act, the representatives voted by state, each state having only one vote, even though in the House, the number of a state's representatives is roughly proportional to the state's population. Thus, as in other places in the Constitution, the small states have an edge. Something similar happens in the case of the election to the vice president, though the Senate does the voting in that case, which is a little odd, but I think it shows that the drafters thought that the legislative chamber closest to the people should have the final say in the case of the president. There are some other requirements, for example, about what constitutes a quorum for voting, but I've laid out the elements I want to focus on this evening. Alexander Hamilton argued that the original mechanism ensured against disorder and cabal, I love that word, and that the electors would be most likely to possess the information and discernment necessary for choosing characters preeminent for ability and virtue. It helped assure against disorder, he thought, because a state's citizenry or its legislature was choosing electors, not a president, and so the stakes were not immediately high. The mechanism ensured against cabal because the group of electors was in existence for only a short time and in fact never convened in one place, and moreover did not constitute any part of the existing national government. The electors were likely to have the necessary information and discernment because they were a small number, chosen from the whole number of citizens. The original mechanism has not quite lived up to Hamilton's hopes. We know that this mode of appointment has not always ensured against disorder. Proof enough of that can be found in the attempt of several states in 1860 to secede from the Union. And there has been cabal aplenty. Even Hamilton engaged in some to assure that George Washington would be the first president. It was a sort of counter-cabal, but cabal nonetheless. He judged that Washington might well be the unanimous choice for president, and he was. But he worried that if there was unanimity for Adams as vice president, a few electors could vote for someone other than Washington and thus make Adams president. So Hamilton proposed by letter to people in Connecticut, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania that their electors cast a few votes, 2 to 4 in each state would do, he thought, for people other than Adams. In the end, all the electors voted for Washington, and half of them voted for Adams. So there'd been no cabal against Washington, or it had died before the voting. But Hamilton had prepared, and in fact, in each of the states Hamilton asked to throw away a few votes were in fact cast for people other than Hamilton, other than Adams. It took quite a bit of letter writing for Hamilton to push his design. Think what he could have done with email and texting until they're hacked. Ultimately, all this maneuvering was made unnecessary by an amendment which separated the voting for president from the voting for vice president. And I think I'm right that both Hamilton and Madison worked to get that amendment through. I'm not sure that Hamilton enjoyed that little cabal of his except as a showing of a sort of competence that's sometimes necessary in dealing with a less than perfect set of circumstances. One writer has even argued that we should recognize such competence as the exercise of yet another liberal art. Have electors always had the necessary information and discernment? I don't know, but I can say that at some point early on, certainly by the election of 1860, candidates for the office of elector sought votes not only on the basis of their information and discernment, but on the basis of the candidate to whom they were pledged. Many of them hoped that their candidate, if he became president, would reward them with a federal office. You'll find in Lincoln's works several documents related to requests from Lincoln's electors to be appointed to an office in his administration. I don't know what happened to those requests. Even the idea that electors should exercise informed discernment has been feared or opposed. In the election of 1860, after Lincoln won a plurality of the popular vote, his supporters were concerned that some of the electors would not adhere to the popular votes in their respective states and would combine to defeat Lincoln in the voting by the electors. A distinguished law professor argued in 1977 that an elector who campaigns on a promise to vote for candidate X has entered into an explicit contract to vote for X and that Congress has the power to enforce such a contract. The professor was responding to a case in which an elector pledged to Nixon in the 1968 election had voted for Wallace instead. Congress accepted that vote. I don't know if the professor would apply the same contract theory to all campaign promises. By the way, Madison, writing in 1825, took a larger view. He argued that an elector had a legal right to change his vote, but in doing so, he must take into account not only any moral obligation to keep promises, he must also consult the public good. Last among the failings of the old system that I want to mention here is that if the voting reaches the House of Representatives, it may turn out not to represent what the House really prefers, and not just because the votes in these circumstances are by states. As I said earlier, since voting is a matter of numbers, paradoxes are nearby, having mainly to do with the choice of what to count in the first place. For example, take the possibility, which is described in the handout I gave you, which Madison put forward in 1823, that the candidate who wins the least votes in the House of Representatives could, in fact, be preferred by that very House to the other two candidates. Consider the following numbers, using the current numbers of states, and the current requirement that when the electors have not achieved a majority, the House votes by ballot on the three top vote-getters, which I will call A, B, and C. Here, please take a look at the handout. Imagine that 22 states vote for A, 16 for B, and 12 for C. By this vote, C is the clear last place finisher, and under the current constitutional rules, that's the end. How then could Madison think that candidate C could in fact be preferred to A and B? Because he was imagining that more than just first place preferences would be counted. The count I've set out tells us, for example, only that those voting for A preferred it to both B and C. Similarly for those who voted for B and those for C. But how did those who voted for A compare B and C? Which did they prefer of B and C? What would their second best have been? Imagine that those voting for A preferred C to B, so that their whole ordering is ACB. And imagine that those voting for B preferred C to A, with a whole ordering of BCA. C, of course, preferred C to both A and B. Now let's count these pairwise preferences. 22 plus 12, a majority of the 50, prefer C to B. And 16 plus 12, another majority, prefer C to A. Counting these pairwise preferences makes C the clear winner. Could such a thing happen? Madison thought it not unfrequent. I think something like it may have happened in the trial of Socrates. Add zeros to all the numerators that I gave you in the handout, and let A, B, and C stand for acquittal, banishment, and capital punishment, respectively. Then the example becomes this. Of 500 members in the Athenian assembly, 220 preferred acquittal, and yet Socrates was condemned to death. One might think that when it came time to choose between exile and hemlock, everybody who voted for acquittal would have joined those who voted for exile and formed a majority for exile. But what if those who voted for acquittal preferred hemlock to exile, and those who preferred exile preferred hemlock to acquittal? Why would two groups think this way? Perhaps because they were unwilling to foist Socrates off on some other city. He himself had argued against exile. In the case of the trial, the second vote on punishment revealed the voters' second bests, and so capital punishment, which would have been last in a so-called plurality vote, emerged the victor. What we've seen so far are congressional voting results that may not reflect the representatives' preferences, electors chosen sometimes by state legislators, not the people, electors who trade votes for public office and who are sometimes discouraged from voting on the basis of their own informed judgment, opportunities for the electors to conspire, even in an age of communication by letter, and sometimes great disorder after an election. All these difficulties can be wiped away at a stroke, either by simply doing away with the electors and any backup role for Congress, or perhaps not so simply, rendering the roles of the electors and Congress wholly without any real effect. How do that? A constitutional amendment would do the trick, but constitutional amendments are rather hard to come by. The next best thing, which Maryland has adopted, is to appear to follow the law on electing a president, while in fact emptying that law of any content that would stand in the way of appointing the chief magistrate by direct vote of the people. Maryland's first step in that direction depends on the provision in the Constitution that gives to states the power to establish rules for choosing electors. First, Maryland and then several other states have entered into an agreement that if it were to take effect, would abolish the office of elector in all but name and would render wholly impossible any congressional involvement in the election. Instead, the choice of president would rely entirely on the votes of citizens. A Maryland statute sets out the two important elements. First, Maryland's electors, there still would be electors, would be required by Maryland statute to cast their votes for the winner of the national popular vote. And that winner would be determined by a plurality, that is just asking for voters' first choices. The electors would still meet as required by federal law, and they would still vote, but they would exercise no independent judgment, whether informed or not, or discerning or not. Their names, even the fact of their existence, would appear nowhere on the ballot, and Congress would have no role because Congress is called in only if the electors reach no majority. But the agreement takes effect when enough states have signed on to constitute a majority of the electors. That would be 270. States have signed on already constitute 165 of those 270. That leaves only 105 electoral votes to go. Even as it waits in the wings, this interstate agreement is having an effect. For example, under Maryland law, electors are already deprived of any independent judgment. The law requires them to vote for the plurality winner of the state's own popular vote. And again, by law, the names of the electors are not to be on the ballot. What is inspiring this effort? Partly dissatisfaction with the sorts of difficulties I was describing earlier, all of which were, in fact, drawbacks even in the eyes of the framers. But also inspiring the new effort is a set of claims about the past, present, and future of democracy. Listen first to the former state senator, Maryland State Senator Jamie Raskin, who introduced the legislation that became the statute I've described. Raskin will very likely be my congressional district's next representative in Congress. To quote, "The whole trajectory of American politics moves toward the beautiful lawyer-like vision of our last great Republican president, who spoke of government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It goes without saying that Americans have been trying since the beginning to overthrow our undemocratic, arbitrary, incomprehensible, racially tilted, and dangerously manipulable electoral college regime in favor of a direct national popular vote for president. It will give the president the popular mandate for the kinds of comprehensive policies that America needs. One person, one vote, all over America, with the highest vote getter winning. This is the destiny of presidential politics in America. In other words, political democracy, nothing more and nothing less." That's the end of that passage. So breathtaking and expansive is this, it leaves me wondering whether he would be in favor of electing Supreme Court justices, settling all questions of policy by referendum, and restoring the Athenian practice of deciding criminal cases by majority vote. Less effusive and more aware that full-on democracy might not always be wonderful is the work of Akhil Amar, a legal scholar at Yale. He offers a sort of non-credo in defense of the pending agreement. "We should ask," he says, "whether we want to maintain this peculiar institution, the Electoral College, in the 21st century. After all, most millennial Americans no longer believe in slavery or sexism. We do not believe that voters lack proper information about national candidates. We do not believe that a national figure claiming a national mandate is unacceptably dangerous, end of the quote. Just dangerous, perhaps, but not unacceptably so. Can he imagine no unacceptably dangerous figure claiming a national mandate? What is proper information in his view? He says it is the linking of presidential candidates to slates of local candidates and national platforms that explain to voters who stood for what. A platform is indeed some sort of information, perhaps even necessary, but it doesn't seem to me entirely proper. Appeals to democratic destiny and millennialism aside, another part of what drives the motion toward a national popular vote is the Bush-Gore election of 2000, in which the popular vote went to Mr. Gore, but the Electoral College vote went to Mr. Bush. In a major document put out by the national organization that's pressing the national popular vote, the writers make note of some genuinely remarkable recent history. They say, two of the first three elections in the 21st century provide good examples of a major flaw in the current system. In the 2000 contest, Democratic presidential candidate Al Gore won 537,000 more votes than his Republican opponent George Bush, but the latter became president. Then in the 2004 election, President Bush won more than 3 million more popular votes than the Democrat John Kerry, but Kerry would have won the presidency if he had received only 60,000 more votes in Ohio. So this works against both parties. Just an aside on how such contrary votes are possible. It's mainly because every state in the union but two awards all its electoral votes to the winner of that state's popular votes. Consider a union of just two votes, one large with 6,000 people, one small with 4,000, with proportional numbers of electors, 6 in the large one, 4 in the small. Let the following be the case. In the large state, candidate N, A, wins the popular vote by 3,001 to 2,999, giving all 6 electoral votes to A, even though really only half plus one of the people voted for her. In the small state, let A lose the popular vote 0 to 4,000. Her opponent gets all 4 of the small state's electoral votes. A wins the electoral vote 6 to 4, but her opponent wins the popular vote 6,999 to 3,001. I'm going to make a counterproposal. I don't believe deeply in it, but I think there ought to be something else on the table. How could it happen that an election mode that Hamilton called excellent, if not perfect, could be about to become, through the Maryland and similar statutes, so deeply undermined? In the remainder of my lecture, I'll consider some arguments against the course Maryland is taking, but I'll also express a certain admiration for a certain spirit of civilized revolution in that course, and I'll grant the possibility that it might be headed the right way. But I'll also set out a moderate proposal of my own. Now, in response to most any proposal, those of you who've read Aristotle's Rhetoric know that there are common places of argument that can be applied, and I will apply 4 of them to the Maryland proposal. The 4 are: we don't need the proposal, it's illegal, it wouldn't work anyway, and I've got a better proposal. So see if you think that any of these arguments are persuasive. First, there's no need for the grand proposal. Despite all the shortcomings I've listed, we've been doing just fine, cockeyed electoral system or not. Look, the country's still here 240 years after the revolution. I do take this commonplace argument seriously enough to make me reluctant to put forward any proposal of my own. People will point to this or that president as having been a bad choice. Certain people will point to Lincoln, for example, people who think he was a tyrant or should have let the rebelling states go rather than help initiate a war in which over 600,000 people died. But note that the grand proposal would not have stopped Lincoln, for he had the largest popular vote in 1860 and a majority of the electoral votes. I'm pretty sure that the supporters of the proposal understand that. The grand proposal, seeking to enchair the biggest vote-getter, will often, maybe even usually, settle on a candidate who is opposed by a majority. What I'm calling Madison's paradox applied to any system of plurality voting. The grand proposal does not require a majority of the popular vote. It only ensures that the electoral vote and the popular vote settle on the same person. The Hamiltonian dream hasn't quite come to pass, and the electoral system now seems to function in large part to distort the popular vote, sometimes reversing it, but not often. My second commonplace argument is that the course Maryland is on is, I think, unconstitutional. I take this commonplace as seriously as the first one. The grand proposal allows no room for electoral judgment. The electors are directed by statute. Congress has no role because the compact ensures there will always be a majority of the electors. There's no independent voting machinery for electing the vice president, even though the Constitution clearly sets one out. In effect, words and provisions in the Constitution have been emptied of their meanings, and more. The Constitution says in Article 1, Section 10, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into an agreement or compact with another state. But there's no plan to submit this particular agreement to Congress. I don't think Raskin and Amar would be much moved by these arguments that the agreement is illegal. Electors' independent judgment seems to have fallen by the wayside long ago. The law of interstate compacts can be complicated, and the Supreme Court is likely to say, as it has before, that the Constitution leaves the appointment of electors entirely up to the states. I must interject here that one is left with a rather dark view of the prospects of Constitution making. If the drafters did not foresee what would happen to their near-perfect provision, if we are now on the verge of completing a project that would wholly undermine the original provision, and if the courts are unlikely to intervene to preserve anything of the original mode, then what is one to make of the activity of writing constitutions? Third commonplace argument: the grand proposal will not accomplish what it wants to accomplish. I consider here three arguments, two of them mathematical, I'm afraid, and you'll be relieved to hear that I've already presented one of them to you on that handout, and that I'll discuss the other only by analogy with baseball. First, I'll remind you that Madison understood that plurality voting on three candidates, that is, asking the voter only what his first choice is, can lead to a situation where the third place in the plurality vote could be someone the voters would prefer to either of the other two candidates. That's no less true under the grand proposal, which seeks only the plurality winner. So voting under the grand proposal does not necessarily settle on the people's choice. Of course, neither does the electoral system. That was Madison's point. But the electoral system didn't pretend to pick the people's choice. The grand proposal does and won't always achieve it. The other mathematical argument is too involved for a lecture and might take a week in a math tutorial. I've never gone all the way through it, but the main point is clear. The electoral system probably increases voter power, where voter power means the percentage of possible elections in which a given voter decides the outcome. What would it take to explain to millions of voters that they have more voting power to choose the president through the electoral system than they would have if they voted directly for the president? But in the course of presenting his conclusions over the years, the mathematician behind this argument, Alan Natapoff, has argued that the electoral system is similar in important ways to the World Series of Baseball. So see whether you think this analogy might make up for not being able to understand his math. In the World Series, it's not the number of runs in seven games that determines the winner. It's the number of games out of seven. One team could win each of the first three games 10-0, racking up 30 runs in three games, and yet lose the next four games 0-1, losing the entire series to a mere four runs by the other team. Nadipov claims that games are to runs as electors' votes are to the popular vote. Counting games rather than runs and counting electors' votes rather than citizens' votes increases, says Nadipov, the excitement of the contest because individual players have more opportunities to employ well-considered and well-timed actions against an onslaught of numbers from the other side. I'm not sure about that argument. The last reason I have for thinking the grand proposal won't work is the reason that interests me the most. Imagine Mr. Raskin and Professor Amar saying the following. Maybe they have, in fact, said something like this. Mr. Crockett, they say, you should take more seriously your own notion that the drafters of the original mode of appointment weren't very far-seeing. Ask why they would have failed. Probably because they were looking in the wrong place. They should have started with direct voting, not mediated voting. We supporters of the grand proposal are simply correcting that error. And please note, Raskin and Amar say, we are doing the correcting in precisely the way the drafters of the Constitution corrected the errors of the drafters of the preceding Articles of Confederation. Those articles said they were not to be changed unless the Executive Council of the Confederation and each of the states agreed to the change. But the drafters of the Constitution did not go to the Executive Council, nor did they require the consent of all the states. Nor do we national popular vote supporters, follow the amendment process laid down in the Constitution. We don't think, as a matter of law, we need to. But even if we're wrong in that point, we should be congratulated for adhering to the Founding Fathers' very civilized form of revolting from the Articles of Confederation. I like this serpentine argument. My imaginary Raskin and Amar should even have added that it is a noble national effort that they have conceived. It submerges, as the founders did, the interests of particular states into the interests of the whole. For under both the Constitution and the grand proposal, a state may be called upon to a support for the sake of the common good, an outcome that may be opposed by a majority of its citizens. I still wonder, though, how much the proposal accomplishes. The Constitution aimed to contribute to a more perfect union, does the grand proposal. There's at least one way in which it doesn't. It has a built-in secession clause, which says any state may withdraw from this agreement. So much for submerging a state's interest to the common good. Here's my fourth and last commonplace against the proposal. I've got a better one, maybe. If we're in the mood for amendments, I've got two. One I've taken from Hamilton. He proposed it in 1802, but I don't think it went anywhere. Its main effect would have been to do away with the freedom that states have to set terms under which the electors are chosen. Hamilton would have had electors chosen directly by the people. He's not entirely an elitist. Remember, in many cases in his time and later, they were chosen by state legislatures, not the people. The people would have voted in districts of roughly equal population, districts that would have been focused on what he called geographical contiguity, not race, nor economic class. Under this provision, the states could not have done as Maryland does, directing the electors to vote a certain way. This amendment could also weaken the effect of political conventions. Right now, the conventions tend to usurp one of the functions of the group of electors, which is to bring forward worthy candidates. John Quincy Adams told Tocqueville that he, Adams, thought many conventions, and he was thinking especially of Southern conventions that had been organized to develop policy over imports and exports, usurped the legislative function. Also, conventions are organized around party and exist over time, and thus contribute to factionalism and discourage the sort of independent judgment I think Hamilton was hoping for in the electors. The other amendment I would propose is that electors not be permitted to serve in the administration that they helped elect. This amendment would disincline the electors to vote for a given candidate in expectation of being given a job by the candidate if she won. I have no expectation that either of these amendments will come to pass. As I come to the end of my lecture, let me return to a point made by my imaginary Raskin NMR. The mode of appointment outlined in the Constitution has come to grief because the drafters started in the wrong place. They should have started with direct voting by the citizens. That I think would be Amar's argument. I must report that James Madison, at least one point during the hot summer of 1787, argued that the people should elect the president directly. In his notes on the convention, he reports the argument that he made on behalf of the people. In what I'm going to quote, he refers to himself in the third person. The people at large was, in his opinion, the fittest in itself. It would be as likely as any that could be devised to produce an executive magistrate of distinguished character. The people generally could only know and vote for some citizen whose merits had rendered him an object of general attention and esteem. Even Hamilton said something similar at one point, but Hamilton's main emphasis was that whoever voted should have the necessary information and discernment. Remember, for Hamilton, having discernment is being able to recognize characters preeminent for virtue and reality. In Plato's Republic, Socrates says at one point that there is, in his city of speech, a certain harmony, a concord of the naturally worse and better about which ought to rule, both in the city and in each soul. And readers of the Republic might conclude that during the course of the all-night dialogue, something like that harmony is achieved, with Socrates as the ruler of the little city at Cephalus's house in the port city of Piraeus. If you and I and every citizen are indeed capable of recognizing who should rule, who is preeminent for virtue and ability, then let us citizens vote directly for the president. But are we capable? Do we know what virtue and ability are in the political realm? Much of Plato's Republic is taken up in describing just who is capable of ruling in their city and speech, but there's no pretense that the sort of harmony Socrates seeks is easy to find. Even you and I would recognize some limits to the popular vote. The Lincoln-Douglas debates are devoted mainly to the question of whether the question of slavery should always be resolved by popular vote. Nor would we allow criminal cases to be resolved by a majority of 500 voters bent on acting in a single deliberation in the course of other business on a single day. Have you no doubts about whether Britain should have decided to leave the EU on the basis of a single popular vote? How about hiring orchestral musicians and baseball players by popular vote? Here's a very democratic proposal. A computer somewhere chooses, at random, from a list of all eligible citizens, one citizen who will then be authorized by law to choose who will be president. Would you want the computer to choose you? If it did, would you accept the task of choosing a president? If not, why not? Because you don't have the time, or information, or discernment, or something else? If you imagine that you wouldn't want to be assigned this task, why would voting alongside millions of other citizens make you any more confident of your vote? You may rightly ask at this point, how does it make sense that I don't have the necessary information to choose a president, but that somehow I can nonetheless recognize somebody who does have the necessary information and discernment and who should therefore vote on my behalf? That's a very good question. But it's one that you should ask not only about the Electoral College, but about representative democracy in all its forms. Somehow, we should try to hold two slightly dissonant attitudes at the same time. And I happen to love dissonance. First, in this audience, as in one of Lincoln's regiments, there are perhaps enough people to fill the offices of government, president, cabinet, Congress, and even the courts. I don't know why he treats the courts as an exception. And of course, the office of elector. But second, none of these offices is easy or to be open to us whenever we wish. But we can hope that we will recognize at the right moments either who can take up these offices or who will recognize who can take them up. Thank you very much.